Liberal and Scientific Society. Today's debate is, this House believes the UK is ready for a Labour government, and there's some amazing guest speakers and student speakers debating today. So on the proposition opening, we have Daniel Rankin, another student speaker who studies politics, philosophy and economics at Queen's. We have Kate Nicole, who is an Alliance MLA in South Belfast and former Lord Mayor. We have Eve Hollywood, a student speaker who is chair of the SDLP Youth and studies law and politics at Queen's. And we have Dermot Hamill, HLM, training officer of Glitterific and law student at Ulster University. On the opposition, we have Grant Warren, a student speaker, who is the current events officer of Glitterific. We have Felicity Houston, who is a tax consultant and former commissioner for public appointments in Northern Ireland. We have Jason Reid, who is the South Antrim representative of the Executive Council of the Northern Ireland Conservatives. And we have Daniel Toft, HLM, a student speaker, who is the treasurer of Glitterific and chair of the QUB Conservatives. So before we start, we'll move on to our vote of priority. So if you side with the proposition on this debate and you believe the UK is ready for a Labour government and everyone can vote on this, please raise your hand now. If you side with the opposition and you don't believe the UK is ready for a Labour government, please raise your hand now. And if you'd like to abstain on the motion, please raise your hand now. And could Mr. Secretary please read the vote of priority?
Okay, there were 18 votes for the proposition, 7 for the opposition, and as I'm informed, I'm not allowed to say something here, 1 vote for the abstention.
Just before we start our speeches, I'd like to read the rules to you. Each speech is 7 minutes long. The first and last minute are protected time, which will be signalled by the bell down there, meaning that you can only POI people in the middle 5 minutes. To POI, raise your hand and say point of information on that point or POI. Please keep your POIs to 10 seconds long and no barking, meaning wait at least 15 seconds after giving a POI to give another one. Also, very importantly, no back and forth. Also, lastly, I don't have to tell anyone here, but no swearing, please. And I guess I will. And we do fine for it usually in ordinary meetings if you swear, but we're not going to do that anymore. And I'd like to welcome Daniel Rankin up to open the proposition.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here and a great privilege to be speaking with some great speakers here. So I would like to start by addressing what I think is really the elephant in the room, the fact that we are instalment without a government for the past 18 months. That's 2 million people of Northern Ireland. And I think that that is fundamentally relevant because the UK, as specifically the Westminster government and specifically the Conservative Party, have a strong disconnect with the people of Northern Ireland, including all of Northern Ireland's political parties. And I'm here to suggest that the solution for that, to some degree, is a Labour government. So a month ago, the Troubles Legacy Bill received royal assent and entered into law. It offers an amnesty to those accused of killings during the Troubles, specifically for those accused who self-confess and cooperate. The House of Commons, a motion to disagree was presented. There were 206 no's and 284 ayes in favour of the bill. Of those 284, 282 were Conservative, and there wasn't a single Tory against the bill.
Point of information?
Go ahead.
Are you to say that the absence of Stormont is directly linked to the fact there's a Conservative government given under the last Labour government Stormont in cold storage for 5 years, and Tony Blair gave former IRA prisoners all the wrong letters, which caused deep, deep disquiet amongst the unionists?
Well, I'm talking about all Northern Ireland's political parties, including the DUP, who have a deep dissatisfaction with the Tory government as well. So, Labour, the SNP, the Lib Dems, the Plaid Cymru, and all of the Northern Ireland political parties against a Conservative bill then. There's clear that there's a severe amount of disunity there. I think that the Conservative and Unionist Party, in its full name, clearly does not believe in unity, and it is quite extraordinary that Northern Ireland politicians, unionists and nationalists have united in opposition to the bill. For the reason being, we are Northern Irish, we either went through the conflict or know people directly affected by the conflict, and we know the effects of the bill on ourselves in our day-to-day lives more than any ivory tower conservative, perhaps. The distance that the Tories have from the constituent countries from the UK beyond just Northern Ireland is increasing. The largest party in Northern Ireland is Sinn Féin, the largest in Scotland is SNP. These are two parties campaigning for their independence from the UK. The largest in Labour is, again, largest in Wales is again Labour. The largest in English local governments is Labour by about 200 councillors.
I'm not quite.
Go ahead.
Was it not the last Labour government that gave Scotland its devolution settlement in the belief that it would kill off separatism, but in fact it is gave a gateway for separatism to use the platform of devolved government to push and agitate for the secession of Scotland from the rest of the UK?
No, but I mean, they lost the referendum in 2014. It's been, even since 2014, there's been an increased sentiment towards Scottish independence and also like that in Northern Ireland as well. Perhaps not to a similar degree in Wales, but there is still a strong Labour movement. So it's been 13 years of Conservative governance, with the last two Prime Ministers completely unelected by the general public. What could the Conservatives be campaigning against but their own failures in 13 years? So here are the five priorities that the Tories focus on straight from their website. So the first is having inflation. Inflation which skyrocketed in 2020, rising to a peak of about 11% a year ago, down to 6.3% today. That 11% inflation was the highest in the UK since 1980 under Margaret Thatcher. And secondly, growing the economy. Now, high inflation obviously has an impact on that. It prevents the benefits from economic growth. It prevents the benefits of economic growth provided to the common person, especially due to the current cost of living crisis seen in, for instance, that the growth of real wages fell from a growth rate of about 4.6% in mid-2021 to -3% last summer, only going past 0% this summer. The third is reducing debt they claim to want. Well, the last time the Conservatives noticeably reduced debt was national debt proportion to GDP was under John Major. Debt since 2020 has exceeded the size of the economy for the first time since 1963, now at about 103%, no thanks, of GDP. Now, for a party that is supposedly economically conservative and fearing low taxes as well as low spending as a method of lowering debt, it's clearly not working, and we need something beyond just tax cuts and austerity. The fourth is cutting waiting lists regarding the NHS. So the Financial Times published research last December showing that the size of the NHS waiting list shot up under Major, fell down under the ground, and rose immensely in the past 13 years, about 200% from 2010. So it's clear that Labour have a much better record regarding NHS waiting lists. And the fifth Conservative priority, supposedly, is stopping the boats. Now, I agree that illegal immigration must be limited, but if the solution as proposed by Conservatives such as Suella Braverman is to further displace hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers by shipping them off like cattle to Rwanda, then I'm not for it, nor is the UN. So that's a clear barrier for my support there. So all these mismanagements don't even consider Brexit. Of course, the false advertisement of $350 million to the spare money from the EU to go to the NHS every week by Boris Johnson himself before he was Prime Minister as Mayor of London. It's another clear example of backtrack. Well, back to the Labour Party. I don't intend on dogmatically supporting Blair's policies such as Iraq, nor Corbyn's policies. He was essentially a Brexiteer throughout his entire career. The era of dogmatic tax cuts under Liz Truss and dogmatic policies like with Sunak ought to come to an end, and I believe Labour is the best, or at least the least worst party in the House of Commons to make such an effort to change this. Now, Starmer is no doubt a moderate of the party, which I'm sure many Labour's lament to some degree, but to them I say, Corbyn didn't get elected twice, Miliband didn't get elected, nor did Michael Foot way back in 1983, so I think the rejection of a pragmatic moderate is a historical misstep for the Labour Party. Starmer recently came out saying the phrase that growth is the answer in reference to the economy, and that is the type of pragmatic but also determined spirit necessary for the economy and indeed the country. Rishi Sunak says he believes in change, We can all say that we believe in change to some degree, but after 15 years of Conservative governments, why would we trust the Tories to make substantial changes this time? In addressing the question, we ought to ask additional, why wouldn't the UK be ready for a Labour government? Thank you for listening, and I hope you will vote for the proposition this afternoon.
Thank you, Madam President and members of the House. Today I'll be considering the question of the fitness of the current Labour Shadow Cabinet for Government in Westminster, and I want to start out by adding some clarity to the motion. The motion today is primarily asking us to consider the suitability of Keir Starmer and his shadow government to step in and assume the reins of power in a manner which shows that they have a clarity of vision for what they want to achieve, as well as the required competence to deliver on the most pressing needs of the people. The proposition will no doubt delight themselves in the opportunity to tear apart the record of 13 years of Conservative government, but I will ask the same question of them that Sir Keir Starmer himself set out as his key challenge at the most recent Labour Party conference, which is to ask the question, why Labour? It's one thing to stick the boot into a nationally unpopular party 13 years into government. It's an entirely different question to shine the light on the party which is supposed to be the government in waiting and ask, is this what we really want in a governing party? Is this really the best we can hope for? I can certainly say, Madam Speaker, that in the opposition's view today, that answer is a resounding no. Keir Starmer's Labour Party is not ready for government because, at a basic level, they don't believe in anything but power. There are a litany of broken promises which is littered across the length and breadth of the UK from the Leader of the Opposition, whether it's his pledges that he made to gain the office of Labour leader in the first place, or the make-it-up-as-you-go-along approach that he continues to employ even now, seemingly on the cusp of power. It shouldn't need to be said that Keir Starmer's supine, spineless spin and Tesco value brand style of policy decision-making draws the deep annoyance of not only his opponents on the right, but his more convictionist erstwhile comrades on the left. And I have to say, when Corbynistas and Democratic Socialists of every shade and hue of red stand up to criticise Keir Starmer's betrayal of his campaign pledges, they've got a damn good point. And for anyone that seems to have conveniently forgotten about them, I have a copy of them here for reference. Members of the House, it is imperative that we take a closer look at his tenure as leader of the Labour Party through the lens of his campaign pledges. While political leaders often make promises to gain support, it is the fulfilment of these pledges that truly demonstrates their commitment to the people they aim to serve. Let's reflect on the unfulfilled aspects of Keir Starmer's 10 campaign pledges as Labour Party leader. These pledges were not mere words. They were a contract with the party members, supporters and the wider public. The unfulfilled promises cast a shadow of doubt on the credibility and integrity of the party's leadership. First and foremost, let's address the issue of party unity and the pledge to bring together all factions within the Labour Party. Instead of unity, we have seen divisions and they continue to persist. The infighting and fragmentation have hindered the party's ability to provide a cohesive and compelling alternative to Conservative government. It's imperative that we acknowledge that unity within a party is the cornerstone of any successful political movement. As the famous maxim goes, divided parties do not win elections.
On that point.
No, thank you. Another promise that remains unfulfilled is the commitment to, quote, maintain the radicalism of the Corbyn era. For those who aligned with the principles and vision of the previous Labour leadership, the shift towards a supposedly more centrist position has been disappointing. Instead, Sir Keir has rode in behind the Conservatives on a raft of issues, such as fiscal policy, foreign policy, public sector pay awards, Brexit, the abandoning of fossil fuels and immigration, while trying to maintain a pretense of difference between his front bench and that of the Tories. Indeed, I only need to quote Matt Rack, president of the Trades Union Congress, who said that after the recent Labour Party conference, Starmer needed to stop, quote, being overly managerial and be more radical if he wanted to inspire people to the cause of a Labour government. Matt Rack gets it. Starmer seems to have left that memo in the same place he left his discarded 10 campaign pledges. Furthermore, the promise of, quote, transparency within the party has been questioned by many. The lack of transparency in key decisions and policy-making processes has raised concerns about accountability. He's used backroom tactics to get delegates favourable to him onto Labour's National Executive Committee to sideline the left of the party, regardless of what the mass membership of the Labour Party wishes. It is essential that we hold leaders accountable for their actions and decisions that affect the lives of countless individuals. One of the most critical issues that Daniel rightly raised facing our nation is the economy. Keir Starmer pledged to, quote, build an economy that works for everyone, but for many, the specific plans to achieve this goal remain unclear. In such challenging times, especially around the cost of living, for the leader of the government waiting not to have even outlined his priorities in terms of tax and spend show a lack of readiness, but also, frankly, a lack of seriousness in tackling the most pressing needs of the people. Lastly, let's not forget the promise to, quote, listen to and consult with members in the, with party members and the public. It's disheartening to see that many feel their voices are not heard or that their concerns are not addressed. Starmer has announced positions while in office and flip-flopped on them completely without a, without a mandate from his people or the or his party. One day he sports nationalising mail, rail and energy, and the next it's no longer a priority. One day he supports free movement, the next it's off the table for good, and he's using the language of the Conservatives on immigration. One day he supports the end of North Sea oil and gas extraction, the next he will limit it simply to the awarding of new licences. One day it's an end to outsourcing in the NHS, and the next it's supporting the Tories' NHS model. One day it's standing with workers, and the next it's sacking shadow cabinet ministers for standing on the picket lines. Most notably of all, it's one day sitting in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet for over a thousand days, while the Labour front branch parroted the lines of states and actors hostile to British interests, and the next is wrapping himself in the flag and telling people Britain's national security is safe in the hands of the Labour Party. Where there's no open dialogue and clarity, members of the House, of ideas and policy, there's simply not a basis for trust. If the price of power is what you believe in, then members of the House, this Labour Party is bankrupt. For a party and leader in Sir Keir Starmer so utterly unable to say what they believe, and when they do say what they believe, it can be thrown under the bus for the whiff of power, how can anyone put their faith in Labour to form the next British government? Madam President, I can say with a great deal of confidence and pleasure, we in the opposition certainly won't be. Thank you.
Madam President and members of the House, I'd like to apologise for my coughing and general illness. I have two small children in my house, but I would like to point out that I still come to work even when I'm sick, unlike some of my colleagues. Where to start? 13 years. Where to start over 13 years? No matter where you live, who you are, what age you are, what background you are, you will have seen the devastating impact of Tory rule. 13 years. In that time, they have presided over the hostile environment. Policy designed to actually make the lives of people fleeing violent conflict all the worse. Ranging from the threat of sending people to Rwanda, a police state, to painting over Disney murals in a refugee centre because they could be too welcoming to children. They presided over attacks on other minority groups. You may recall David T.C. Davis's Traveller, a Gypsy leaflet. These acts are designed to distract from the real problems created by austerity, mismanagement of the economy and public services, and they are shameful. In those 13 years, they have presided over the rolling back and watering down of net zero commitments, squandering the birthright of future generations and putting all our futures at risk. For what? It's shameful. In that time, David Cameron threw the entire country under the bus to appease Nigel Farage and UKIP. We're still paying the price for it now. Shameful. In that time, following the US into the mismanagement and withdrawal of Afghanistan, resulting in the Taliban coming back into power, the human rights ramifications, denial of human rights for women and girls in particular, have had a lasting effect. It's shameful. In that time, there have been bullying allegations, Priti Patel against civil servants, Dominic Raab bullying allegations against civil servants. Don't even get me started on Boris Johnson. I only have 7 minutes. He broke the COVID guidelines, left, right and centre, Partygate, cash for cushions, illegally proroguing Parliament and then lying to the Queen. I could go on, I won't, but it's shameful. Matt Hancock breaking all kinds of COVID guidelines and regulations that he helped to create. Rishi Sunak breaking all kinds of COVID guidelines that he helped to create. Liz Truss-onomics and her mini budget and the inflation and mortgage crisis which then ensued, remarkably achieved after only a couple of weeks in office. It's shameful.
On my point.
No. Nadine Dorries, I just put a full stop after that. The cancellation of HS2 and the squandering of public money, the decimation and steady erosion of the welfare state and public services. It's shameful. The misunderstanding, mistreatment and disinterest in Northern Ireland before, during and after the Brexit negotiations. My honourable friend discussed the legacy bill opposed by all parties. They have no interest in Northern Ireland and it's shameful. The creeping privatisation of the NHS and movement towards notional health service, waiting lists going up and the service being run into the ground. It is shameful and it is having an effect on people's lives. The failed privatisation of water, of trains, Royal Mail, telecommunications providers and energy, it's all shameful. Sewage spilling onto beaches right across England, what a metaphor for Tory rule. Honourable friend described Labourers as bankrupt. The Tories are bankrupt, they are morally bankrupt. They are self-interested and don't we deserve a little bit more than all of this? One of these examples is shameful, but all of these combined just show that they are the worst government, arguably, we've ever had. The question is, we're ready for a Labour government. I put it to everyone here that we are ready for any other government. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam President. Ladies and gentlemen, can I first say how delighted I am to be here this afternoon and to take part in this debate. This takes me back to my student days when we used to enjoy good old ding-dong in the debating society at Nottingham University, and when we weren't fighting there, we were fighting at the Students' Union, so I'm sure you're all the same. And it's lovely to be back. I can pretend I'm recapturing my youth. So I'm delighted to stand today in support of my colleagues to oppose this, to be honest, faintly ridiculous motion that this House believes the UK is ready for a Labour government. And why do I say it's ridiculous? Well, because there's a major technical flaw in it. It refers to the UK. But as always, this offer does not apply in Northern Ireland. Why? Well, because if you live and vote here in Northern Ireland, you're not allowed to vote for a Labour government, are you? The British Labour Party will not field candidates here, nor allow British citizens registered here to vote for them. So what we think about the nation's readiness for a Labour government is really neither here nor there to secure anti-apparatchiks. And it's sad because, you know, 30 years ago or more, I was involved in something called the Campaign for Equal Citizenship. This campaign wanted all the national parties, those who provide the fundamental functions of a state, to organise and field candidates here. But it wasn't until a legal challenge in 2003 that the British Labour Party finally allowed citizens here to become members. But of course, they still refuse to put up candidates, and so we still can't vote for them. So who would want a government with such an attitude to some of their citizens? We're taxpayers, well I am, most of you haven't got them yet, but we're not voters. I think there was quite a successful revolution in America several hundred years ago about that very point.
On that point, for example, Liverpool didn't have a constituency somewhere in England, is that sort of like...
Sorry,
Kate. Is this going to be like a carte blanche for a secession of a small English town just because Labour are feeling themselves in a constituency?
But they stand everywhere in England, as far as I know. And throughout the rest of the United Kingdom, the Labour Party field candidates. This is the one part they don't. They've made a policy decision that they will not put them here. So that's why we have no influence on the Labour Party and its potential as a government. No member of the Northern Ireland voter can ever rise within the party and become a member of government, for example. So that's the fundamental issue.
Conor McGill, MP.
Yes, but he doesn't live here, does he? He lives in England. he's not registered to vote in Northern Ireland. That's the point. If you're registered to live and registered to vote in Northern Ireland, you cannot be the member, you cannot become an elected MP for Northern Ireland. So that's the difference. It's a fundamental issue about democracy. And so we really have to wonder, do we want a governing party that considers us paddies basically not fit to deal with complicated national politics? We're just going to stay here, as we have for many, many years, dealt with our own nationalist issues and just stick with that because they don't think we're up to anything else. I don't know what their other reason is. But even if, yet again, we're forced to just sit this one out at the next general election, as far as the Labour Party is concerned, we should maybe think about the implications for the rest of the UK. Should it take a punt on Sir Keir or stick with Rishi? Are we really ready? Were some of us ready in 2019 when Magic Grandpa and Momentum were championing the best, waiting in the wings to answer the nation's call? Of course, with Sir Keir's rounding endorsement of and support for Corbyn and his leadership. Never forget, Starmer planned and campaigned for us to have a Labour government run by Jeremy Hamas on my friends, Corbyn. Yet within how many weeks after he took over, was Corbyn out on his ear, banned from standing as a Labour candidate? I do have to ask, which is the real Sir Keir? The one who was happy to serve in both Corbyn's shadow cabinet and perhaps a future government? Or the one who threw Corbyn to the lions when it suited him? Is the UK ready for a man like this to be our Prime Minister and form a Labour government? Do you think we could trust him? Currently, he's abandoned his plans to rejoin the EU, but who knows what might happen once he settles into number 10. What will that phrase, "we don't want to diverge from EU rules," actually mean? So that's what we have to wonder about for our future if we have a UK government that's run by the Labour Party. But what's the evidence that it's ever a good idea to have your country run by the Labour Party? Those of us who have lived through one or two, and I have thought Steve Aiken would be here and I'd be able to say, "Steve, remember, can you remember what it's like?" But it's only me by the look of the room. Ready? Are we ready? Well, after a few years, I have to say you'd be more than ready to give it up. Blair and New Labour. Oh yes, you know, things can only get better. I'm a pretty straight sort of a guy, tells us Art Tony. This is the man who basically sold peerages to the House of Lords. In return for people who loaned the Labour Party money, he gave them peerages. And I know this because I was a member of the House of Lords Appointments Commission when we found out what he was doing. He was interviewed by the government, by the police about it. Anyway, he's the man who took us into an illegal war which killed how many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis? I was one of many in the biggest demonstration in the in UK's history against that wicked and insane policy. A policy based on total lies. We went ahead, and let's not forget that much of the instability in the Middle East at the moment arises directly from that war. He and Alistair Campbell should hang their heads in shame when Blair tries to tell us what to do to solve the problems. Once Blair had, of course, been manoeuvred out, we were left with the gracious and beguiling Gordon Brown, some of you may vaguely remember him, the man who sold our gold reserves to fund New Labour spending, who tied our hospitals and schools into ridiculous PFI contracts. When the dust settled after the banking crash, his chief secretary to the Treasury left a note for his Conservative successor saying, "I'm sorry, I'm afraid there is no money. Kind regards and good luck." That's what New Labour left behind. And I don't keep going on about how old I am, but I can't help but notice it. And I'm actually old enough to remember Labour running the country in the 1970s. You think things are bad now? In the 70s, under Labour, inflation rose over 20%. In 1978, interest rates were 12.5%. I think that does to your mortgage, your parents' mortgages. At one point, the dead went unburied and rubbish was no longer collected. I can remember walking around London with the piles of rubbish heaped up in the side streets and squares. I'll not spend any more time this afternoon depressing you all about the memory of my memories of just how the Labour Party cannot run the country. So instead, I will now ask that the House votes against this motion to confirm that the UK is not ready for a Labour government, and even more so, that it is not ready for the damage that such an outcome would cause to us all. Thank you.
As the American poet and civil rights activist Maya Angelou said, if you don't like something, change it. Members of the House, I do not just dislike Tory rule, I despise it. In the current two-party system in the UK, a Labour government is the only credible alternative to a Tory one. Members of the House, we have had 13 years of Tory rule. Granted, in these 13 years, the Tories have increased nearly everything. Food bank use, by 40% from 2020 to 2021. Inflation at record levels. Waiting lists currently at 7.7 million in England alone, and most importantly for them, the wealth of the UK's billionaires skyrocketing by over 1,000%. It is time for a Labour government. The past 13 years have been characterised by instability, incompetence, and in it for their mates. Instability caused by Prime Minister after Prime Minister, including one who was outlasted by a lettuce. But let us not deviate. Incompetence. Where does one begin? Brexit, COVID, child poverty, immigration, education, no thank you, transport, economic policy, infrastructure. I only have 7 minutes or I would go on. Brexit, full stop. COVID, in the middle of a pandemic caused by an airborne virus, how did they make things better? Eat out to help out. Between August and September 2020, the Tories spent £500 million of our money, increasing the number of COVID clusters by nearly 20%. Childhood poverty, when it is soaring, what do? Cut meals over holidays for the most impoverished kids in our society. Immigration, campaigning to reduce levels of immigration and wondering why there is such a shortage of workers. It isn't that hard to understand. Education, how to work out A-level grades when there are no exams, an algorithm which only works for their mates who have kids in private schools.
On that point.
No, thank you. Transportation, a £14 million ferry contract fell apart. Why, you ask? Because the ferry company didn't own any ferries. Economic policy, Trussonomics, which lasted 50 days. Infrastructure, announcing the cancelling of the HS2 route to Manchester whilst in Manchester. Incompetence, incompetence, incompetence. Although in all fairness, they're not incompetent when they're in it for their mates. £2.1 billion worth of COVID contracts handed to companies politically connected to the Conservative Party, and more than two dozen contracts handed to companies controlled by either Tory donors or linked to senior party figures or members. Instability, incompetence, and in it for their mates. And let's not forget about immorality, or should I say, amorality. We all remember the daily message, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. But that message was only a message for us. To them, it was party on, protect the Tories, save Boris. While young people like us helped protect the NHS, missing out on rites of passage, people grieved alone, people died alone, and people were alone. But remember their mantra, party on, protect the Tories, save Boris. In the words of Shelley, rulers who neither see, nor feel, nor know. But perhaps I have been too critical of them. Credit where credit is due, the Tories have managed the unthinkable, to unite every single political party on the island of Ireland, but unite them against their legacy bill. The victims on all sides of our conflict, like every other ordinary person, simply do not matter to the Tories. Widespread condemnation from international human rights lawyers and victims groups demonstrates that this is a callous attempt to hide the truth, deny justice, and subvert democracy. Members of the House, if you care at all for the victims of our troubled past, it is time for a change. When the current Secretary of State, the Right Honourable Chris Heaton-Harris, was challenged by a local councillor about cuts to vital services for young people in Northern Ireland, he accused him of, and I quote, and pardon my language, talking bollocks. This government keeping it classy for 13 years. The damage done over the past 13 years will take at least a decade to undo, as Keir Starmer recently acknowledged. The reality is, a Labour government will not be a panacea for all of Britain's problems, yet their track record on the NHS and the peace process, as examples, would suggest a more humane approach to the problems facing the UK. Their pledges to renationalise railways should lower fares and encourage public transport, benefiting both customers and the environment. The creation of a new publicly owned clean energy company has the potential to harness Britain's sun, wind and wave energy to save £93 billion for UK households and should deliver 100% clean energy by 2030. Members of the House, this is not even about being ready for a Labour government. This is about needing a new government, requiring a change to reverse the catastrophic damage inflicted by 13 years of Tory misrule. Let's have a government that is stable, competent, and for the many, not the few. I therefore implore you to support this motion.
Say thank you all for inviting me along today. It's a pleasure to be here. I've heard some wonderful speakers from both sides so far. Hopefully I can add to that. So where to start? Of course, I'm on the side of the opposition today as a Conservative member. And today I will argue that Labour are unfit to govern due to their policies being unrealistic, irresponsible, and their propensity to flip-flop on key issues and key policies, and then being a risk to the UK's future prosperity and stability. Firstly, a word on the current government. We've heard plenty about it today so far, and that's, I think, how we've got to this point, and that's key, because that is why we're talking about the possibility even of a Labour government. I think the key to recovery after such a tumultuous period is stability. And stability hasn't perhaps been a word widely associated with the current government term. Unsurprisingly, I think it's fair to say, given that this government has had to deal with a number of once-in-a-generation events in a relatively short period of time. Brexit, the global COVID pandemic, and the fallout from the Ukraine-Russia war. It's been the most challenging period post-war any government, and I believe it's only due to the series of completely unforeseeable events cascading one after the other that we're even discussing the prospect of a Labour government. But thanks. I'll try to keep the Brexit stuff to a minimum here because I know we're all ready to move on for dominating the public discourse. I personally didn't vote in the referendum. I don't have a dog in this fight. I didn't feel I was armed with enough information to make an informed decision. So for me, I'm somewhat neutral on this. But the Conservative government has stayed consistent with the pledge to carry out the will of the people on Brexit, getting Brexit done, and it's not wavered from this course, despite the fact the Conservative Party leader at the time and Prime Minister, David Cameron, campaigned for Remain. That's what he was fighting for at the time. Nonetheless, the party worked to carry out the will of the people of the UK when they voted to leave the EU.
Did they work to carry out the will of the people of the UK whenever they implemented the protocol and brought about a broken Brexit for Northern Ireland?
Yes, I'll get on to that. Shortly. In Northern Ireland, we've had constant instability with our local government, even before that time. The protocol and the Windsor framework that this government implemented has gone some way to address that. This government's worked to come up with a common sense solution
to
geographic realities.
How's it going?
The geographic realities we face now in Ireland. While we're part of the UK, we do share a land border with the EU and with our neighbours in the Republic of Ireland. The sensitivity of this border and the communities in Northern Ireland where we live, it's at odds with the main political parties over here. This government's not been afraid to make these decisions in spite of this, in the absence of the unanimous support of the parties here, making brave decisions that cut to the heart of the issue and require compromise on both sides of the political divide here in Northern Ireland. Both parties, both of which have been guilty of pulling down local government at various times over the last 6 years for different reasons. We do this to provide a more peaceful and prosperous Northern Ireland in the future, so that no one side here gets their way. There's realities here we have to be aware of in the United Kingdom while living in the island of Ireland that require compromise that some people find tough to swallow, but that is where we are in Brexit. To ensure that we are still in the United Kingdom, we remain an integral part of the United Kingdom, but that we don't have a hard land border with our close neighbours in the Republic of Ireland and the EU as a result of the decision the UK made collectively. This government stood firm in carrying out the will of the people on Brexit, unlike Labour, who have switched positions on this issue at least once. So where do Labour stand on Brexit? It's a great question. Difficult to answer, though. We know they've called for a second referendum on Brexit at least once in order to attempt to win the 2019 general election. Under Jeremy Corbyn, more recently, Keir Starmer pledged to reintroduce free movement as the first step on the pathway to rejoining the EU eventually, but since has reversed that stance, with their now leader promising to make Brexit work, quite similar to the Get Brexit Done slogan, at the recent Labour conference, stating that there was no case to be made for the UK rejoining the EU, and being at odds with prominent members of his own party, such as Sadiq Khan, Labour Mayor of London, for example, who's pushing for the UK to rejoin the single market. Let's also look at the current positions of Labour on their ideological values. Nationalism, nationalisation of public services. Keir Starmer ran for leadership on a pledge to bring rail, mail, energy and water under public ownership. He reiterated this stance in August 2021, but in September 2021, he ruled out nationalising the energy companies, and in October reneged on his pledge to nationalise the railways. In 2021 then, Rachel Reeves, Shadow Chancellor, pledged to end the charitable status of private schools and has just dropped this pledge in September of this year. As was mentioned earlier on, July 2022, despite being a proud supporter of the trade unions and standing on this premise, Keir Starmer banned his frontbenchers from attending the rail strikes that were taking place last summer. Four of them defied his orders, including the Shadow Transport Minister at the time, who would later be sacked for the show of defiance against his leader. Speaking of his leader, Keir Starmer in January 2020 declared local party members should elect their candidates for every election without wider interference, before he then went back on this and banned his predecessor as party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, from running as a candidate. In defence of this flip-flopping confusion and division within the Labour Party, I believe it's simply because the Labour policies are based on populism and ideology instead of rational evidence or pragmatism. Another example that's quite prominent this year actually in the public discourse is Keir Starmer during an interview with LBC regarding women's sports, being unable to answer the question, does a woman have a penis? Doubling down on this stance by calling out his own MP, Rosie Duffield, for daring to state that only women have a cervix. Only this week, we've heard that under Labour government, deliberately misgendering someone would be classed as a hate crime in future, potentially punishable by jail time, ideology, over evidence. Finally, the propensity to increase public spending at a time when the economy is still recovering from the global pandemic would be reckless without a clear and coherent plan as to how this would be funded, without massive increases in borrowing. We can forget the infamous letter that we have as a prop just here, left by the Secretary of Treasury, Liam Byrne. I'm afraid there is no money. Indicative of how irresponsible Labour were with the public purse the last time they held power. Just want to touch on the word leader, finally. Leader, some might say, is someone who knows where they're going, has conviction in where they're going, can inspire others to follow them where they're going, and hold their nerve regardless of the sacrifice required to get there. In Keir Starmer's Labour leader, the word leader itself, in this instance, is used very loosely. I urge you to reject this motion. The UK at this time needs a government who prioritises pragmatism, stability and financial restraint to build the UK back better and stronger than before. The UK deserves better than a Labour government, and the UK is not ready for a Labour government. Thank you.
What a fool I was! I was only a puppet, and so was Ulster, in the political game that was to get the Conservative Party into power. Lord Edward Carson said that after the Home Rule crisis, when the Conservative Party once again flip-flopped on its own policy over the Home Rule bit. And, shock, horror, the Conservative Party are now once again flip-flopping on their own policies. HS2 was one of the big Tory infrastructure projects. One of the great bastions of May, Cameron, all of this. Finally, we can finally bring about a proper infrastructure project. And then Rishi Sunak absolutely bins it. Talk about flip-flopping. Flip-flopping on Brexit. Theresa May was the big Remainer, then gets into power, goes for a soft Brexit, her party tells her no, goes for a hard Brexit, her party tells her no, then she goes for a Northern Ireland happy Brexit, Northern Ireland tells her no. She doesn't really, when we're going to talk about flip-flopping, let's do some introspection here, my dear friends on the opposition. Our latest speaker on the opposition also pointed out how the Tories know better than the elected parties here in Northern Ireland. No one side will get their own way, and yet when it came to the legacy bill, no side got their own way. Education, education, education. Those were the great words of Tony Blair, whereas Liz Truss decided inflation, inflation, inflation. That's her legacy. The highest tax burden in generations of the United Kingdom. That's what we now face to get here. One weak second, my dear friend Grant. They've implemented the protocol here in Northern Ireland. Then they said, no, we're not going back to Brussels. We will maintain the protocol because it is best for Northern Ireland. And what did they do? They went back to Brussels with their tail between their legs. And then they delivered the Windsor Framework, the new deal that was going to deliver for all of us here in Northern Ireland. It would scrap the sea border, but wouldn't really. It would essentially give the sea border in fancier, more complicated language for farmers from dear Port of Vogue. You see, here in Northern Ireland, the Tories, as evidenced by our dear friends in the opposition, think we don't really understand politics. That's why our elected reps can't be trusted to make our own policies.
On that point?
1 week's second. Of course, let's talk, but I want to first of all focus in, before we really get into the meat of the motion, I want to look at us on the international stage. Now, I've been many a time quoted as an adamant Republican and nationalist, but I'm going to put myself in the shoes of a dear, God-fearing, union-loving Brit for a wee second. So get your union jacks out and maybe I'll say some nice things about the union. But don't quote me. So, the international stage. The United Kingdom, the great British Empire as it once was, the sixth largest economy in the world, an international superpower. And then we chose Brexit. And then we said, oh, we will continue to be a global Britain, as dear Boris Johnson said. Then we started firing money at Ukraine, taking in all the refugees of the day, except the refugees that didn't come from Ukraine. We destroyed our position on the international stage. That's why Joe Biden isn't very interested in any kind of deal with us unless we get Stormont back up and running.
There's been a current thread through the proposition's arguments that Brexit was exclusively pursued by the British government of the day. Does that mean that they're under insulting the intelligence of the millions of British people who did vote for Brexit, including hundreds of thousands of mostly unionists here?
No, I was a Brexiteer. So, listen, I think that Brexit, in my view, from my position of political republicanism, was a good idea. Because look at the state of the place. It's not going great for the Union. But no, I don't think that, you know, I think that the idea that we all know better than the good people of the United Kingdom, I think I know better. That's because I'm great. But outside of that, I don't think that's the argument. I think the Brexit delivered in comparison to what the Brexit should have been, what people were sold in terms of what Brexit would be, are two very different things. I think had they been given the proper Brexit that people want, then perhaps we would have a much better global Britain here and now. But I do want to actually focus on the arguments put forward by my own side. I want to actually look at Labour as the proper alternative. And what have they offered? I'll admit, I think Keir Starmer's a bit of a wet one. I think, as Edward Carson as well once said, nothing Ireland's north, south, east and west has suffered so much as the broken pledges of British statesmen. And again, I would say the same will likely be said for Keir Starmer. No doubt he's not perfect, he's far from the perfect politician. I think the front bench kind of sucks a little bit. But when you compare it to the guys on the other side of the chamber, well, I'd even take that. But what they're offering now is a repeal to the legacy bill, thank God, because let's be honest, none of us here want it. They're offering an attempt at political responsibility, political openness, political sensibility, moderation in politics, the exact kind of, I suppose, what conservatism is meant to be. Where it's an end to dodgy deals and corruption, it's the legacy of Labour is Good Friday Agreement, while the legacy of the Conservative Party is personal protective equipment.
On that point.
No thanks, I'm coming up to my end, I'm afraid, here, Grant. But it's an end to populist policy for the sake of populist policy. It's about proper climate action. It's about delivering for the NHS. It's about delivering for the economy. It's about actually engaging with the European Union and our friends right across the world, rather than simply sticking our two middle fingers up at them because we can and because we're Britain. It's about actually bringing about a United Kingdom that is working for ordinary working people. It's about working for the middle classes, and to perhaps an extent the upper middle classes. It is about a Britain that will actually work. It's about education, education, education. It's about dealing with the protocol in a way that is acceptable to the Northern Ireland people. Not somebody saying, well, this is the deal they're getting, so suck it up. About getting rid of sewage in the rivers. It's about actually focusing on HS2. A house divided is no house at all, as seen with why there have been 5 Tory leaders in 13 years. Cameron, May, Johnson, Truss, Sunak. The infighting is mad, just as bad as it is on the other side. So listen, my friends, I urge you tonight, I beg of you, I beseech you, vote with the proposition, because otherwise you are continuing that legacy of failure, of corruption, of dodgy dealings and backroom brown envelopes. Let's not act like Bertie Ahern. Let's deliver proper politics, proper policy, proper fiscal policy. Let's have an actual global Britain, and let's make the place start to work. Thank you very much.
Madam President, members of the House, it's always quite hard in this society to have to follow Dermot. When I had heard Dr. Aitken had sadly stepped down and Dermot was the replacement, I was just thankful that I was last on the opposition. So I didn't have to be ripped apart by him here. I'd just like to recall my first ever political memory. I was about 8 or 9 in the back of the car ahead of the 2010 general election. And I saw 3 posters of 3 men. One was Gordon Brown, one was David Cameron, and the other Nick Clegg. Me being a 9-year-old or 8-year-old, I'd heard of Gordon Brown. I hadn't heard of the other 2 men, and I thought Gordon Brown was probably wearing quite a nice suit. So I asked my mum, this is in Northern England, in Wakefield, a historically Labour vote town. I asked her if she was going to vote for Gordon Brown, the only one I knew. It was as if I had sworn at her. I just recall the response being something along the lines of, why the hell would I do that? But I feel that today the opposition have this afternoon demonstrated why the British Labour Party, headed by comrade Sir Keir Starmer, is simply unfit to govern the United Kingdom. But I must tell you, my favourite part of the proposition's argument this afternoon was having members and representatives from some of the parties of government here, or formerly parties of government here, complain about budgets and the ability to finance properly, given that the parties in government here left Northern Ireland with a £600 million black hole in their budget, which the Secretary of State in Westminster had to clear up. So, you know, my colleague Grant, my comrade Keir, only believes in power and is therefore unfit to govern. At each obstacle, he's told his electorate, whoever they are, exactly what they want to hear. Whether it's telling Labour Party members that their 2017 manifesto was the party's foundational document, remember that? Then proceeding to scrap most of the foundational change that it offered, or declaring to the country that the attacks against the former Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, were, quote, terrible, before rightly removing him from the party. If, as Labour leader, he's disappointing his own membership base, how could we possibly trust his word on any of the pressing contemporary policy issues which we all require credible answers to? This also extends to his shadow cabinet and the wider party, which are just as much of a threat to the country as the leader is. Let's look at his shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy, who in July 2018 voted against the renewal of the UK's nuclear deterrence trident, which sits as a cornerstone of the nation's security and the security of our partners across Europe. He made an impassioned speech in the House of Commons, not one that I agreed with, but all the same, you could tell he was saying what he believed on the issue, which is quite refreshing. He highlighted his Christian background prevented him from supporting the renewal, as well as political beliefs and his early grassroots start in the campaign for nuclear disarmament. Again, not a stance that I would agree with, but
you can kind of, you can see his point. Fast forward to 2023, and having watched his leader U-turn on just about everything masterfully, Lammy writes an article in the Telegraph talking about it was how it was Labour who helped establish the UK's nuclear programme and how his commitment to it is, quote, unshakable. Perhaps send him an Oxford Dictionary and maybe demonstrate to him what unshakable means. But another politician willing to kick his beliefs to the curb just for the taste of power. But can we risk this? Can we risk the cornerstone of the UK's national security, which ensures the safety of every single person sat in this room today, being used as a political tool by a party who clearly don't believe in it just to get to office? What happens if they change their minds again? No, thank you. My opposition colleague Jason has touched on a major crisis that the UK government has had to deal with throughout the term, Brexit, COVID and the like. I just feel that it's been lost a little by the proposition. And my opposition colleague Felicity has touched on how the prospect of a Labour government doesn't really apply to Northern Ireland because we don't have a say in it here. Labour don't field candidates here. But Labour have to, by their constitution, field candidates in England, Scotland and Wales, but seem too scared of the lovely people here who have welcomed me to this province so greatly in the last 3 years. Now, Dermot here said that a Labour government would be, quote, the end to dodgy deals. And I would kindly suggest to him that maybe a chat afterwards with my opposition colleague, Felicity, who sat on the House of Lords Appointments Commission during Blair's years, might change his mind on that one. But the issue of Labour in power not only scares me due to the reasons that I and my colleagues have already outlined, but also because of Labour's track record in office and my personal experience of them. Only recently has the Conservative-led UK government been forced to appoint independent commissions to oversee and step in if needs be. Decisions taken in Labour-led councils with a particular focus on spending. Labour-run Birmingham City Council has faced a budget shortfall of £87 million and has issued a Section 114 notice effectively declaring bankruptcy, having already paused non-essential spending in July. But due to the spending decisions of the Labour Party, that council can only commit to providing statutory public services, those that are required by law, such as the education function and bin collections. Other services that people enjoy, such as libraries, leisure centres and various other community programmes that you'd expect your council to run, are all at risk. It's also yet to make a decision on whether to raise council tax, a move that would not have been otherwise necessary had it not been for their financial incompetence. But Labour's bad decision making and poor funding affects me personally. I live in Wakefield in West Yorkshire, which is governed by a metropolitan council with a Labour supermajority, God help us. Two-thirds of councillors are Labour and the administration has been Labour run for as long as anyone can remember. You probably have to go quite far back to find a time when it wasn't. Despite not being effectively bankrupt, they're already trying to slash services that aren't required in order to plug a massive £35 million hole. But services in Wakefield are already dire, with the government making similar action a couple of years ago in quite a local public scandal around children's services. But with core spending on various public amenities in the city conveniently going to be more Labour voting east of the district rather than the west where I live. Personal experience with Labour has told me not to trust them, not to trust them with our economy or to make the right decisions in the future. Take it from someone who has been forced to experience Labour locally all his life. You can't trust them. Vote for the opposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. And now we'll move on to questions. So how this works is anyone can ask a question. They'll be asked for, say, the proposition, then the opposition respond. There'll be proposition questions, and abstaining questions, and only one person from each side can respond for each question. So you can talk amongst yourself and decide who it is. Do we have a question for the proposition, Ryan?
So what's the view? It's been kind of split, as some of you have just talked about how bad the Tories are. But for those of you who did touch on the point about what Labour is an alternative and laid out some of the things that Labour would do differently or the benefits of a Labour government, considering Keir Starmer's track record of flip-flopping on literally everything that he's promised to his members, how could you trust him to actually deliver any of that?
One person to respond.
PhD is gone.
I'll go for it. My message. Well, they used to it. Well, I think part of it comes down to a certain, I suppose, political. I don't want to say political morality, but I suppose when you look at it in kind of terms of what's happened, I mean, whenever you look at kind of what has happened within his party, he flip flops on an issue, people lose the rag. I think if it comes to it, whenever it comes to Labour voters, a lot of people, whenever he does eventually flip-flop in government, which realistically he will do, I think there's going to be a certain amount of, substantially more kind of rebellion within his own party in terms of his voters than there would be across the House with his Tory friend. And I think as well, just a lot of what you mean, in fact, his polls are saying he's only getting a very slim majority, so he's going to have to do as he's told, right, hopefully.
I think, as we very ably demonstrated, was that he can't be trusted in anything. Like, this man wakes up in the morning, has an idea of what he wants for breakfast, and then by lunch he's decided something different, or he has, or he, whatever, he just changes his mind as he goes along. And it's really sad in this sense, because at least you can say, and people have used the example of Trussonomics and how that went and all the stuff, you can say that that was a disastrous political tenure, of course you can. But Liz Truss was a woman who you could not say was that anyone was in any lack of clarity in what she believed. That she was a convictionist believer in free markets, in an economic liberal approach to try and unlock growth that had, and to try and disrupt an economic consensus that had been in place for going back 25, 30 years, probably since the 90s really. So what you get on this side of the House is a clarity about what people believe in. And that also gives people on the other side the right to say that the Tories are morally wrong, because we respect their strongly held beliefs. What we don't do is we don't stand over a vacuous, makes it up as he goes along later, and try to say that our offer on the table is more substantial and more credible than yours.
And do we have a question for the opposition? Tom?
I kind of want to run with this flip-flop idea, because it's been levelled by both sides, by both parties, in different points of this debate. And that idea of the clarity of trust and analytics, it feels a bit like kind of going where the Conservatives, you're turkeys, here's Christmas. Do you know what I mean? It's the difference. Now, I agree that Conservatives will likely probably flip-flop on a lot of things. Like, I chance the coalition, even if it's abandoned an awful lot of what the core platform is. So we can't say for sure what Starmer, what Labour are going to do. We can say with some certainty what the Tories are going to do, and they've shown that it's fairly catastrophic time and time again. So, I mean, let's take the ambivalence of this and a hope that it might be better against the near solid guarantee of whatever the Tories are going to bring in, which has been shown, and time again, given that you look at the conference, will probably be every bit as disastrous as it has been in the past, specifically 4, 5, 6, 7 years.
Opposition up to here. I think you have to look at the evidence, as I tried to say when I was talking, the evidence of what the Labour government will do to the country. I'm not, I may be a member of the Conservative Party, but as I always say, we're not a cult. And as most people who would ever hear me speak would know, I have very little in common actually with the current Conservative Party. You know, the evidence is that, you know, you're going to take a punt, as I suggested, because maybe they'll do a better job this time. They never have in the past. You know, so why this time? That would be my concern about it, never mind the ideological issues. Why do we think that this time we might get it right? Because they never have in the past.
Proposition.
I think the proposition is answered, or the opposition is kind of answered for us. We can take a punt on the Tories and hope that maybe after the last 13 years, or whenever the next election, probably 14, 15 years by that point, that they might, after all of this time of being really bad, might be slightly less bad, in contrast to take a punt with something that really, when you look at quite a lot of the outcomes of the last Labour government, quite a lot of it was quite nice. I mean, the Child Trust Fund's really nice. I just paid for a cruise with my own. You get, I mean, there's the NHS, I like that. You know, it's still going. It was quite nice. I mean, that was a Labour win. You know, funding for, you know, schools was quite nice. I like that. You know, so you have a choice between look at all of these things that the Tories have done in your lifetime that have been really awful and take a punt that they may be less awful, or look at the last time, which, you know, a lot of it was pretty bad, but quite a lot of it was quite good as well, and go, we'll give them a shot. So, you know, take your choice.
And do we have any abstaining questions? Do we have another question for the proposition? No?
I can try and abstain question.
Okay.
There were a few things that the proposition mentioned that were called sort of Tory policies. I think the words that were used were incompetent and shameful. And an awful lot of those policies, if you take as an example, perhaps the abandonment of HS2, a lot of stuff on healthcare, a lot of things in the economy, that Keir Starmer has openly said, we can only work with the hand we're dealt, we're not going to change any of these shameful and incompetent things. So is there a bit of a kind of a consensus among all eight of you, and maybe in the room, that everything's just going to be useless, and we're kind of just hoping for the best of our heads above water? Or is there a genuine positive alternative within the Parliament system in Westminster that can actually do anything decent for us?
Probably can you respond first?
I mean, I think the it's a big question. I think the main conference of our men is that over the past 13 years can't really get worse. This might not be the best government that you've ever seen in your life, but it is a better alternative to what's currently on offer.
No, we
don't. opposition as well.
Yeah. At times I sort of wonder if this motion is more around change for change's sake, just for something different. We've seen that in Poland quite recently, where the polls shifted from right to left, and New Zealand, where they went the other direction, left to right. After the global pandemic and all of the fallout, no one's happy with the economy the way it is. People just want change, something for change's sake. I think we have to ask ourselves what that means in terms of what Labour will actually bring to the party. We've already discussed how Labour, we don't know exactly what they'll do, they'll probably do the opposite of what they're saying now, bits like that. There's been a term I've heard this week where the Labour Party are wearing the Tories' clothes to get into power, and then they'll take them off. I'm not going any further that analogy, but Keir Starmer. So and I think looking at the Conservative Party, and as Felicity said, the ideology we have, the principles we have will continue. No one on this side of the table, much less the rest of the Conservative Party, would stand up and say there's been no mistakes made over the term. But what we do have is a vision, and communicated that quite concisely with our five pledges, say, for the year. I think at least we know what we're getting with the Conservative Party. We can see what we're trying to do. We've come through, as I mentioned in earlier on, three of the most ridiculous events that any government could ever put up with, or hope to deal with in post-war time, the global Brexit, the global pandemic, and obviously the Ukraine war. Pieces within those we've got right, pieces we've got wrong, but always been striving for to get to the right answer for the people. So I say that for us, it's a case of, are we saying this, are we mentioning this because people have fatigue of what's there, and just change for change's sake, or do we really believe, does the proposition really believe that this Labour government is the answer?
Now we'll move on to our vote of speaker ability, and this is not your actual opinion, this is which side you think spoke best. So if you think that the proposition spoke best tonight, please raise your hand. And if you think that the opposition spoke best, please raise your hand.
Do we vote?
Yes.
We could vote. I'm sorry, I voted the wrong way there. I'm actually up here.
And if you would like to abstain, you don't think anyone spoke well, or you think they all spoke so well, you can't decide.
Sorry.
Stop. And so we have 11 votes for the proposition, 12 votes for the opposition, so the opposition have it. Thank you all for coming tonight, the guest speakers especially. Thank you to Grant Warren for organising this event in Stormont, it means a lot to the society. And I think that we have a room booked in Horatio Todd's afterwards. And also we're going to get a big picture on the stairs out there, so if you all please make your way out there.
No, hitting Todd's.